It's the 19th of August 2022, and I'm interviewing Don Trask, who was an aerial mapper in Hawke's Bay. Don is going to tell us about his life in Hawke's Bay, time as an aerial mapper, as well as about his family and interests.
Right. Well, I guess my story begins on the 12th of July 1934, when I was born to Eric James and Winifred Caroline Trask, née McDougall, in Hastings, New Zealand. My dad, Eric, had been called back to Hastings from Whanganui, later accepted as correct in Māori, the WH, where he had started his working life in the post office. His mum, Mary May, and father, William James Trask, Jim, together with his sister, Beatrice, and brothers, Donald and Gordon, and a niece, Audrey Beale, had gone on an Easter drive in 1930 to a spot north of Napier where there was a rocky outcrop on the beach near Whirinaki, known as Penepawa. James took the two boys around the seaward side of the rock to explain the geology exposed by the king waves, which had weathered the face, to tell an interesting story. Always subject to the king waves and steep shingly beach, it was tragic when one rolled in and washed the three out to sea. Mary May, Beatrice and Audrey were still in the car, but when the men failed to return, Audrey went down to see what had happened and saw the three out beyond the waves. Donald managed to almost reach the beach and Audrey took his hand, but the undertow was too much and he was washed out again. The alarm was raised and the police sent to help went to the wrong spot. A number of those on the beach tried to effect a rescue and one was drowned. A young Napier Boys High School pupil, Johnny Johnston, did manage to rescue one and was awarded the Royal Humane Society's Medal for Bravery. Some years later, Johnny Johnston was invited to a Heratonga Swimming Club's reunion and met up with me as one of the organising committee. Eric was contacted and returned to Hastings that same night to join his mother, sister and cousin, who were living in a house on the corner of Ellison and Sewell Roads in Hastings. From there, he arranged a transfer to the telephone exchange in the Hastings post office. On February the 3rd, 1931, the Hawke's Bay earthquake struck and Eric was given the task of checking the mass of telephone lines which went from the top of the building, that's the old post office, across to a single pole with many crossbars and insulators, from where the individual lines dispersed to the homes of the users. On his return to the office, he went to a landing at the rear of the building and looking across the yard towards Karamu Road, he saw Audrey, who was working at the Hawke's Bay Farmers Meat Company. They waved to each other to ensure both were okay. At the same time, his wife-to-be was employed by Mr. Williamson, to me, Uncle Will, in a bookshop right next to the post office. One of her duties was to open a bookshop on the railway platform when a train was due. After the earthquake, this was more a full-time site because of the damage to the main building. Eric was reticent to approach the girl from the bookshop and so asked Audrey to introduce them. Audrey and Winifred McDougall were known to each other and had both completed the clerical course with Wynne topping the class. The romance began between Eric and Wynne and they were duly married in St. Andrew's Church on the 13th of April 1933. The first of their two children, Eric Donald, me, was born 12th of July 1934. By this time, the family was living at 805 Ellison Road, just half a block from where the Trask had been at the time of the drownings. The earlier times, Jim Trask and the family had been working in the milling business at Rangitawa on the main trunk railway line with William Reeves, Jim's brother-in-law, Jim, and another name I can't remember. In lieu of pay, during the Depression, they developed an area of felled bush into farmland provide food for the families. This was subsequently taken under the Public Works Act for a railway settlement. They then shifted their clearing and development across from the Dreadnought Road to the Cooney Road. Then, in the mid-20s, they shifted back to Hawke's Bay, where Jim became a mill foreman for McLeod and Gardiners at Pukatipu. In 1927, they were listed in the electoral roll as living at a number of Brunswick Street, which I don't know, before settling at that home on the corner of Allison and Sylvan Roads. A little over 5 years later, Peter was born on the 2nd of December 1939. By this time, Don had started at Parkwell School after an apprenticeship in the kindergarten, which met in the Methodist Church Hall in Hastings Street. My first memory was meeting an older boy with a butter box cart on the corner of Allison and Willow Park Road. In the cart, the older boy had it full of apples, and he gave one to me. The truth was that I had escaped from 805 and was on an adventure. The incident with the cart boy is as clear today as what happened this morning, and I was probably only 3 years old, certainly preschool. The rest of the exploration is not so clear, but the family, finding me missing, were in a panic and set about searching. Apparently, being Saturday, in those days late night shopping, they were able to follow my route, which took me to Bunker's Toy Shop, which I was familiar with, then across Heratonga Street to the billiard saloon in the Grand Hotel building. From there, I went onto the railway platform in Russell Street and was pushing a trolley around when one of the railway men recognised me as Max, grandson. At that time, Mac, my grandfather, was the railway ganger and lived in a railway house along the track on Market Street Extension. Phew, Don was found. Don's first teacher at Parkwell School was Miss Bain, followed by Miss Pickett, then Miss Farram, Miss Benson, with Mr. Harris as Form 2 teacher in my last year. The teaching was based on the Rudolf Steiner philosophy, and the experimental teaching was a valuable experience for me. During the time at Parkwell, which had its own swimming pool, I not only learned to swim, but became proficient and was encouraged by the headmaster, W.B. Rowe, to join the Heratonga Swimming Club. As the tallest boy in the school alongside Les Scott, you see the class photos, I did perhaps have a small advantage and won a few races. On one occasion, using the diving board, there was a loud crack as the board in the final bounce broke and landed in the pool. Mr. Rowe, who was somewhat hard of hearing, was down in the dressing sheds and heard the noise. It was reported that, without looking, he said, "That will be Trask." From Parkvale, Don then went as a busboy to Napier Boys High School in 1947. Starting as a third former in a trades class, I was told halfway through the year I should have been in the professional course, and so moved with the task of catching up with the rest of 3A. The next move was to change from a busboy to a boarder at Send House. The first term saw me in a large dormitory, then in the next term in a room on the veranda of the principal's house with Barry Wake and Ted Trafford, and I have just found Barry Wake in one of the homes in Hastings. And the next move was to Harwera Technical High School at Form 5 level. Another catch-up year. In the first few days there, I attended a rugby meeting to find two of my Sindhouse fellows, Mac and Boyd Ellison, sons of Dr. E.P. Ellison, had also shifted during the term break. My school year was another catch-up year, and when it came to sitting the exam, I had a dose of influenza, which affected my performance and led to a failure. I decided to leave the high school and join the National Dairy Association as a potential lab technician. Three of us, Bob Perks as leader, Roy Brock, and myself as juniors. At the same time, determined to pay a school certificate, I joined the correspondence school and did my study in the evenings. Having experience as a Boy Scout in Hastings, I was asked to help with the Boys Brigade as a sergeant under leader Larry Gross, who later became a Presbyterian minister. When he left for Australia to further his experience in youth work, Bob Perks took over both as Bible class leader and Boys Brigade captain. This coincided with the 1951 National Wharf Strike, and a few of us left with the assistance of a local father, Mr. Barrett, who drove us down to Wellington to catch the Inter-Island ferry to Lyttelton. En route to an international Boys Brigade camp in Waipara, north of Christchurch, this was an experience I had. I remember being placed in a cabin on the ferry, which, from its shape, was up in the bows of the ship. Of the 21 passengers there, I was the only one not seasick, but when I entered a bell tent at Waipara, I fell flat on my face and the effects of the ship's motion took over. My time in Howrah was quite important to me as a growing teenager. The St. John's Bible class was a source of many friendships, as was the swimming club, the Boys Brigade, and the Mount Egmont Alpine Club. I played in the second 15 at high school, spent time competing at swimming, and did some teaching. As a member of the Alpine Club, I spent time on the mountain skiing, climbing, and on working bees for the construction of the Kapuni Hut. It was whilst working on the hut that, after carrying two loads of materials from Dawson Falls to the site, I sat down to have lunch and stretch my legs out, when crack, my knee joint failed. The cartilage, which had been giving trouble for some time, finally split, and I could not use my right leg. A couple of the team went down and located a stretcher. It was pretty primitive, being sacking and two poles. But did I care? The boys took me back to the track at the falls, and after arriving home, I was hospitalised for a time before an orthopaedic surgeon from Wellington removed the bits of cartilage. Today, 70 years on, I'm starting to feel the after effects. Luckily, I had managed, before the knee problem, to summit Mount Egmont under the guidance of Rod Syme. On one occasion, my friend Noel Coates and I went to Dawson Falls with the team, and after a climb to the top of Phantom's Peak, spent the day skiing. In the Syme's hut toilet, there was an amusing sign. "We aim to please you. You aim please." At the end of the day, Noel and I left the hut at about 4 p.m. with the knowledge that the ice cap was setting in. We glissaded down to the falls in just 20 minutes, climbed on our bicycles and headed home. Still aided by the downhill, we passed through Kapanga another 20 minutes later, then started the long slog home to Howrah. Can't remember how much longer. The work at NDA went on, and when a shipment of glass bottles intended for the sterile injections we were manufacturing, the railway strike meant we were forced to store the shipment in a shed in Normanby, just north of Howrah. None of the three of us had a driver's license, but I had some small experience, and we took a company truck and shifted the glassware from the railway wagons to a shed at the rear of the hotel. A small number were returned to the Howrah storage, but unfortunately, in the wet, the cardboard liners washed into the bottles, necessitating washing before sterilisation. In fact, the steriliser was not as efficient as it should have been, and the sterile solutions, unbeknown to us, started to grow mould. In effect, the operation had to be closed down. But before this, I had elected to join the Air Force as a flying cadet. After attending interviews in Wellington in early 1952, a long wait started with no apparent decision, and the start date for the Elementary Flying Training School course almost there. I phoned the RNZAF movement to find that the selection personnel had referred my medical to the aviation GP in Howrah for a check on blood pressure. On calling the GP, I found that he was at a conference at the Chateau. This was finally cleared, and movements sent the necessary travel documents for my passage to RNZAF Tari. I was one of two accepted RAF entrants, with the understanding that after Tari, I would be bound for the United Kingdom. Because of the delay, I was a fortnight late arriving at Tari, and the course was well underway. Posted to sea flight, I found I was with the experienced trainees, some of whom had 1,000 hours in their logbooks. It was not until some years later that I found as a 17-year-old, the others were all 21-year-olds. It was midwinter, and the flying training in Tiger Moth was a trifle cold. My instructor was Squadron Leader Aubrey Bills, a very experienced pilot and adjutant of the reserve. He flew a Mustang fighter based there. He was something of a perfectionist who tended to shout if you dared make a mistake, and I found this off-putting. When he was on leave, I had another instructor who was relaxed. I went solo in the prescribed time and was gradually catching up with my ground subjects. My two roommates were Ron Peterson and Len Cowper. Ron had been employed as a non-flying person with NAC and decided to change to aircrew. Len's father was an officer in the Royal Australian Air Force and had similar aspirations. Ron went from New Zealand to Germany and was killed in the crash of a Sabre jet sometime in the next few years, and Len became chief pilot for Cathay Pacific. In an interview with Squadron Leader Fitzwater at the course's end, I was faced with the opportunity of remustering to the next course, but felt the future was a bit uncertain and decided to return to Hawera. I was almost immediately invited to join a Bible class group heading for a debating competition in Palmerston North. This was accepted and the weekend was spent there in some great company. On my return to Hawera, I was told by my mother and father that I had been asked if I would attend an interview with Pete Van Ash in the hope of a job with New Zealand Aerial Mapping. This proved an excellent opportunity, and after the interview, I was appointed to the position of Flight Planner Navigator. This position had been held by Peter Marshall, who had been flying in Germany during World War II, and ended up in a prisoner of war camp and was in the Great Escape. Cyril Whittaker had taken Peter's place as a step towards piloting the aircraft, and his family and mine were friends from early days in Hastings, hence the opportunity. Moving back to Hastings in the latter part of 1952, I boarded with my McDougall grandparents, Dougie and Mac, at 110 Stortford Street. NZAM office was at the top floor of the building in Russell Street, next to the post office over Popplewell's, Warren's Bakery, Mrs. Ingram's, and looked across the street to the railway yards. Training commenced immediately, as Cyril was to attend an RNZAF multi-engine flying course at Wigram. So, into the nose of the Beechcraft 8011, which had been set up as a bomber trainer with excellent visibility and a plate glass forward-looking window intended for the Norden bombsite. Cyril sat in the co-pilot seat behind and called instructions to me, the new pupil. After a few hiccups, the pattern settled down and I went solo. A year of settling in followed, with flights all over the country, getting used to the then unusual tasks and fitting in with a new group of fellow workers. Christmas 1953 was approaching, and Queen Elizabeth II was visiting New Zealand, home to Hawera for a family Christmas. Then a memory was the Queen processing through Hawera on Friday, the 6th of January 1954, and on Argyle Street, the locals had lined the roadside with hydrangea heads side by side. Back to work in the new year, and on Thursday, 28th of January 1954, we ended up in Invercargill for the night. We attempted to book into our usual hotel, only to find that our rooms were taken by Her Majesty. We all had to find somewhere, and so I ended up at Peter and Maggie McDougall's at West Plains. They were my grandfather's brother and his wife. Next morning, there was a civic reception, and the crew attended as the weather was not suitable for mapping. It was quite an occasion, and imagine our horror when we saw the Union Jack broken out on the flagpole, hanging upside down, an SOS. Later in 1954, NZAM was asked to cover the Western Samoa group, and preparations were underway. About mid-May, I cannot locate the diary, Morris Bosher, the production manager, and I drove to Auckland to board the Matua for the transit of Cyril Whittaker, our pilot, and me as navigator. Before we boarded, Morris and I had a look around and in the process went to Mechanics Bay, headquarters of Tasman Empire Airlines, Teal, to see the Solent flying boat which served Samoa. While we were there, we saw a mechanic working at the rear of one of the starboard engines. Suddenly there was a shout, and the mechanic leapt out of the nacelle and ran along the wing in a ball of fire. His companion kept shouting at him to jump into the water, but he was close to the wing root before he jumped. Cyril met up with me next day, and we found our way to a cabin on the Matua. Settling in, we were surprised to find we had the company of a pair of bulls and crates in front of the cabin window. We were to meet the bulls a few days after their arrival in Apia, when they were invited to Macmillan's at the reparation estate, Mulifanua. There were the bulls quietly grazing. We were to establish a fine friendship with Mac and his wife, and had many experiences with them during our stay. New Zealand Ministry Works had provided a half-round hangar for us, with three rooms for sleeping and storing our personal gear. Next door lived the O'Callaghans, who were responsible for the airfield, and we mealed with them. Ted, his wife, and two young children, a girl and a boy, looked after us well. Cyril and I arrived on the Matua, and Pete Van Ash and Alva Cutler in AHO with an RNZAF navigator. Pete went on to the UK to attend a Hunting Aero Surveys conference, and the team of three settled in. We started mapping shortly after, but quickly discovered that the flight plans provided by New Zealand Lands and Survey, who were to use the photography for production of contour maps, made it impossible task because of the nature of the topography and the daily cloud built up. The only way we could achieve cloud-free cover was to plan runs across the island and choose the clearest one each day. We managed to cover the whole of Upolu and 90% of Savai when, on the rarest of afternoons, managed to fly a tie run the full length of Upolu. Most days when we managed some cover, we mealed in Apia at Aggie Gray's Hotel, and some years later revisited. If the weather was not suitable for mapping, we would explore the island's places of interest, such as Robert Louis Stevenson's tomb, Falefar Falls, or more often we would go sailing in a catamaran built by Mac and his workers using two large breadfruit logs carved to make a hull, then a plank deck to join the two together. It had a set of sails, and we had a lot of fun sailing around the lagoon near Mulifanua. On one occasion, we had Mac and his wife, their little one, and jazz singer Mavis Rivers. I was at the helm when the fishing line we were trailing snagged on the reef. I had to sail back along the line, then come up into wind to release it. Unfortunately, I was not quick enough, and the location of the snagged line was missed. In frustration, Mac said he would swim down the line instead, and in he went. The little lass called out, "La mai!" Shark! And so Mac was quickly back in the catamaran. Another attempt at finding the location of the snaggy ended up with the realization that it was not snagged on the reef, but we had foul-hooked a turtle. This was pulled aboard and we returned to shore. Alva was keen to take a movie of the Samoan boys catching a turtle, and so the two locals went out in their pow-pow and reenacted a typical capture. It was our wish that the turtle then be freed, but the tradition was that you eat what you catch, and so reluctantly we let the boys follow their tradition. On one occasion, Cyril and Alva visited the site where the movie Return to Paradise, featuring Gary Cooper and local girl Moira MacDonald, was filmed. I headed into Apia and spent the afternoon with a friend, Pedro Tatrine, who had come to Apia to teach at one of the local schools. Somewhat based on the Samoa experience, 2 years later in 1956, the company decided to spend a month to 6 weeks closer to where the important work and best weather prevailed. We spent 1956 away, time-based, in Invercargill, and living in a crib on Arete Beach. We found that in order to find clear conditions, we had to fly under cloud all the way to Gore before we could climb to mapping altitude in A1 conditions. The following February-March period, we managed to find accommodation in a house at Frankton, adjacent to Queenstown, belonging to the Fred Lucas family, who had moved to the Shotover Hotel, and there we lived for the next few weeks, cooking for ourselves and harvesting mushrooms and blackberries and catching trout to supplement our home-cooked meals. If we had a busy day flying, we would have our evening meal at Eichardt's or in Queenstown. For the next few years, we repeated this pattern, shifting into an unoccupied crib next door. In that time, if the weather was not clear enough for mapping, we would go around the area exploring the countryside. We had trips up Lake Wakatuku to Glenorchy and tramp into the old home of Paradise. On one occasion, we explored the Capels Valley on the western side of Lake Wakatuku, staying in a hut which had been used by an early Governor General. The valley was home to protected fallow deer. They were a delight to see, and in quite large numbers, and they brought home a set of palmated antlers. One of the projects was the strip mapping of all the state highways throughout New Zealand. One which was not complete was State Highway 6, which took the traveller down the South Island west coast, finishing at Lake Mauraki, before continuing from a few kilometres north of Haast Pass via Lakes Wanaka and Hawea to Invercargill. We drove from Queenstown over the Cadrona to Hawea, then on to the end of the construction, about where it crosses the Burke River into the Haast Valley. The construction folks bulldozed a track across the river to enable us to join the completed road down to Haast Township. Jim Meal, who had joined NZAM after retiring as Assistant Surveyor General, provided the transport in his Morris 1800. At one point, just before Haast Pass, the road went down into a creek. Jim drove down the slope with the water, where the car stalled. His comment was, "The sign at the top said forward, but we are in a Morris." The 1800's distributor was right out front, so the stall was inevitable. From Haast, where there was an airfield, which we did on occasions use, we went on south as far as Jackson Bay before returning to Queenstown. Other places we took the opportunity to explore were the Greenstone and the Rootburn, and on one occasion, because we were in and out of Milford Sound with our mapping, we took the opportunity to walk Milford Track up to the cairn on McKinnon Pass before returning to the Sound. An earlier visit to the Sound was when the Tourist Corporation had just opened the hotel. We stayed the night in the hotel, and the cost of meals and accommodation was £5 each. Wow! During our Queenstown stays, we mapped large areas of fieldland with power schemes such as the Manapouri, lots of central Otago and Southland, including dams and irrigation schemes. Unfortunately, on one occasion, just northwest of Queenstown at 25,000 feet, I experienced an attack of altitude sickness, and the work had to stop. I won't go into the rest of it. Because of what happened on that occasion, my flying had to stop for quite some time. I continued to be responsible for flight planning and was joined by a number of trainees and assistants. One of these, David Napier, continued with the company even after 1989 sale to the opposition when the senior staff were all told to clear their desks. After 37 years, this was a bitter pill, and we did not qualify for the dole as we had not been out of work for a long enough period. Fortunately, the statistics department were looking for staff to carry out the census a year later, and I was selected as supervisor for Hamlet North and was joined by assistants. This meant choosing a staff of 30 plus enumerators and was an interesting challenge. For an office, we had the whole top floor of what had been the post office, and the team we chose did an excellent job. Again, in the next census, I was appointed supervisor for Havelock North, and the team were based in the upper floor of the Hawke's Bay Farmers Building. This, of course, only lasted a short time, and then it was back to the unemployed in the hope of work. The department could not provide anything. Then they did come up with something, scrub cutting in the car wickers. This I turned down, and 6 months later went on to the dole. The obvious alternative for which I had experience was to set up as a consultant, for I had a lot of contacts in local bodies and was an associate member of the New Zealand Forest Service. Two forestry jobs for which I had the qualifications were in Kenya and in East Kalimantan, but these disappeared. And on a business visit to Wellington, I found the New Zealand Forest Service staff all twiddling thumbs and wondering what their future would be. It was soon clear that this was not going to provide an income, and so, So I decided to retire and look after my wife, Aurea, and maintain our property at Havelock North. Aurea had mobility problems from birth, but refused to let this affect her life and did everything others were doing, including as a senior girl guide, tramping in the car wickers. After our wedding, in the next 5 years, she gave birth to three girls, and then we adopted two boys and took responsibility for a little girl who, as a foster child, became a member of the family. Over the years, Aurea had given care for a number of social welfare foster children for short spells. One of these, Hayley, was in touch again in 2021. After retirement, I had to endeavour to maintain our half-acre property, which took a lot of time and effort. Aurea and I kept in touch with all the members of the family as they became adults and started their own families, two in Auckland, two in Melbourne, and two in Hastings Napier District. I have always felt that there was some activity that I could contribute to, should I put my hand up. Over the years, I have enjoyed being involved in a number of these, though because of my duties as navigator for New Zealand Rural Mapping, I became somewhat unreliable. We had to chase the fine cloud-free weather in order to achieve suitable aerial photography of anywhere in the country which was to be mapped. This also applied to a number of Pacific Islands, including Norfolk, Fiji, Tonga, Niue, Samoa, and the Solomons. Some say we covered from North Cape to Stewart Island, but I say from Three Kings to the Snares, and this included the easternmost island of the Chathams. Then I've got a list of involvements that I had. The Heratonga Swimming Club, the Hastings Scouts, Heratonga and St Andrews, the Boys Brigade in Hawera, the Hawera Swimming Club, I was a Sunday school teacher, Frimley, Havelock North, and then superintendent in Havelock North. St Andrews Session, Hastings, where I was ordained by Reverend Alec Mitchell, moved to St David's, Hastings, and then to St Columba's Havelock North Session. And I retired after 60 years as an elder, now an elder emeritus. I was on the school committee at Tamata Primary, home and school at Havelock North High School, hospital chaplaincy committee and organiser of bed pushers from St Columba's for 15 years, the establishment of Spelled Hawke's Bay and its first president, president of Hastings Hearing Association, Hastings Heritage Trails, I was a committee member and did research.